Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Protests in Hong Kong and the standoff with the Chinese government paint a riveting and in some ways frightening picture. What started in March as a protest against a controversial law has grown into something much larger, a demand for greater freedom and for investigations into police brutality. But a leaderless uprising hasn't been a winning strategy in the past, at least not yet. In this week's episode, we're considering what the protests mean for Hong Kong, for China, and for the pro-democracy movement. Joining us is David Rennie. He's a columnist for The Economist, and Ilaria Maria Sala, a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong. We're also joined by a special guest who has asked to remain anonymous. For the purpose of this interview, we'll call her Anne. She's a Chinese reporter who lived in Hong Kong. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Every weekend, the streets of Hong Kong are filled with protesters. The clashes between protesters and various security forces are escalating. What is the world watching? I think a lot of people who aren't intimately familiar with Hong Kong's recent history might wonder what's going on and wonder why it matters and wonder why the Chinese are reacting the way they are. And what do you think?
So what we are looking at this summer is a lot of protesters going on the street to march and to demand for more freedom and democracy in Hong Kong. It started with the extradition bill, which is a very unpopular bill that Hong Kong people do not want. But later, now it seems the movement has evolved to higher level of demands, which starts from the withdrawal of the bill, not only the withdrawal of the bill, but also to ask for an independent commission to investigate into what happened in the past, and also the universal suffrage. So we can see a lot of young people, they are going to the street to demand for more rights and more freedom. When I was reporting Hong Kong, I saw their like young parents taking out their babies, their kids to the street to march in the rain. And we can see bus drivers to they would sit in the bus, but also try their best to play their part into the movement. And we can see working professionals from all walks of life. There are lawyers, nurses, teachers, and all kinds of people. But most importantly, the majority of the protesters is the young generation, aging. They are middle school students, university students, and recent graduates. So they are really people from all walks of life, and it's very extensive. It's not only the young generation, you can also see the older generation. And so it's very, so we can see it's voices from the whole society, not only the young people.
Ilaria, as Anne mentions, flame that lit the fuse was a bill having to do with extradition of suspects to mainland China from Hong Kong. The bill was rescinded. The bill no longer exists, but the protests go on weekend after weekend. How do you explain that?
Well, the bill technically still exists because we only have the promise that the bill will be withdrawn officially next month when the Legislative Council reopens. But unless we are facing extraordinary bad faith, the bill should be withdrawn. However, in the first 2 months of protests this summer, before the bill, before Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, announced that the bill would be finally withdrawn, the government was mostly absent, mostly unable to have any kind of dialogue with the representatives of either the pro-democracy parties or indeed anyone among the protesters, and they have left the police to deal with everything that was happening in town. The police has been behaving with an extraordinary amount of violence. We have seen last week Amnesty International produce a report where they detail cases of abuse, of force, unnecessary force, and even two instances of torture. We have had a few videos by the New York Times, which have also tried to recreate what has happened at certain peak moments during the protests, and they too come to the conclusion that an excessive amount of force was used. We have up to today 1,557 people who have been arrested, and many have been arrested in what seems to be a rather arbitrary way. Also, we have had for the first time in Hong Kong, but then getting since the handover, that is since 97, but then now getting kind of nearly a usual occurrence, that the police does not emit a letter of no objection to protests. So what had started as a protest only against the extradition bill has morphed into a profound gap between a rupture between the police and the population. The police also have been shooting tear gas canisters in highly high-density areas, so people have been getting gassed even if they were sleeping in the rooms in their flats. And this has really changed entirely what we see on the ground. During the Umbrella Movement in 2014, there had been instances of excessive violence from the police. However, what has been happening in the past 4 months is definitely unprecedented in modern Hong Kong history since the handover, but also during the late years of British rule. The Hong Kong police was seen as the best in Asia. Actually, the term was Asia's finest that they were calling themselves as, and now it's seen as a force that hates journalists, hates protesters, hates even passersby who have been getting arrested by the dozens.
David, the world is watching. China is not a place that normally brooks dissent. Is this an important moment for China, not only internally, not only in Hong Kong, but for the rest of the world that's trying to figure out how to deal with a rising country?
That's right, because this is really, if you take a step back, this is an argument about an extremely important promise that the leaders of China made many decades ago, which was the promise of one country, two systems. Your listeners will remember that when Hong Kong was still a British colony in the run-up to the handover back to Chinese sovereignty in 1997, the then leader of China in the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping, came up with this really very imaginative, radical solution to the idea of how do you keep Hong Kong's dynamic capitalist markets kind of buzzing along when at that time China was really much, much less capitalist than today. And he came up with this phrase of one country, two systems. And he was really pretty explicit that the people who he imagined would run Hong Kong after 1997, when the Chinese flag was raised over that British colony, that they didn't have to love the Communist Party, they just had to love China, that he wanted the brightest and the best to keep their jobs, to keep running this place that would still be capitalist. And he had these phrases about, you know, that the horses will still run in the racetrack and the stocks will still sizzle and the dancers will still be dancing. And that was the kind of the promise. What's really been going on for the last several years, really back to about 2012, is a sense in Hong Kong that one country, two systems, that promise, is not being kept. That bit by bit, the government in Hong Kong taking orders from Beijing is breaking that promise, and it's feeling more like one country, one system. So in some important ways, though, this place is still very different from mainland China, and these protests we see every weekend here absolutely could not happen for 5 minutes, let alone 100 days in mainland China. So Hong Kong is still very different, but in lots of important ways, it feels like it's being squeezed. And that's really what we're seeing, that big picture about, is China willing to keep that promise if it involves tolerating, as you said, dissent, tolerating a diversity of voices, not full democracy, but an opposition? Is it willing to let people from an opposition party run for the mini parliament here, the Legislative Council, and though they'll never have a majority because they rigged the rules, will they let them just be there as an opposition? Things, of course, unimaginable on the mainland side of the line, but imaginable here and very much part of that social contract. And I think that if your listeners are trying to work out why sitting in America should we care about that, what we're seeing weekend after weekend with these increasingly violent protests is that the social contract between the people of Hong Kong, who live a much more Western-style life than anyone else in China, their social contract with the rulers in Beijing is breaking down. And what Beijing does next, how heavy Beijing's hand is in response, will of course play into everything that the West wants to know about where China as a whole is going, as China becomes probably one of the world's most powerful, if not the world's most powerful country in the 21st century. What kind of country will that be? Hong Kong will be right now a bellwether of where it's going.
Is there interest in China in being assertive and showing that now a powerful, confident China is big enough, a big enough power to throw its weight around and say to the world, yes, we know about that 50-year transition period in the 90s when we didn't have as many cards on our side of the table as we do today. We made agreements that we don't really think are operative now. Hong Kong's China. China is Hong Kong, and we're moving on.
If you ask the government in Beijing, the communist leaders in Beijing, are you abandoning one country, two systems, you know, years early, they would hotly deny it. They would say, absolutely not. This is just about, one country, two systems. There's still a capitalist system. There's still freedom of the press. They're still free to march peacefully. This is just about people have to love China and they cannot be pro-independence. There are dangerous forces in Hong Kong who are trying to split Hong Kong away, egged on by foreign forces and foreign black hands, the Americans, the British, who are instigating these protests, which are much too large and much too organized to be organized by Hong Kong themselves. That's the propaganda line that you will hear from the central government in Beijing. The real answer is that they don't actually want to roll in the troops if they can possibly avoid it. We've seen the TV pictures deliberately leaked by the Chinese leadership of armed police, the People's Armed Police. It's like a paramilitary police force gathered in very large numbers on the other side of the border, just across the border. There's already thousands of troops here have been since the handover. They don't want to have to use that force because they know that that would be unbelievably damaging to Hong Kong's other ambitions, which is to become a very wealthy, influential country around the world. And they know it'd be a tremendous setback to spill bloods on the streets of Hong Kong. The problem is that although they would say, no, this is still one country, two systems, we're just, making sure that people obey the rules and don't defy China and don't try and become independent, what's really been going on over the last few years is that they've become impatient with being disagreed with. They've become very, very intolerant of dissent, very intolerant of oppositions. They've been breaking and bending the rules to make sure that people who are too different and too diverse can't run for office, get excluded from running in elections. They've put people in prison for kind of just basically organizing peaceful protests. So in many, many ways, they've been squeezing this place that has the political culture of a Western liberal democracy, but doesn't unfortunately have the legal framework of a Western liberal democracy. So that's the tension that we see at work here.
And are people in the rest of China aware of what's going on in Hong Kong? If part of the Chinese reaction is to show who's really in charge and who's really boss and to not allow a culture of dissent to grow there, are they worried that people in other parts of this huge country will be aware of what's going on daily in the streets or certainly heavily on the weekends, what's going on in this place?
From the mainland perspective, I think China, Beijing government is definitely very worried about Chinese mainlanders knowing what's really going on in Hong Kong. So in the beginning, so they censored all the information. In the first 2 weeks of the protests, it was If you were living in mainland, there's no way that you can find out what's going on in Hong Kong because Beijing didn't want people to know. They don't know what's going on at that time, and they blocked all the information, and they are very worried that people, mainlanders, would find out what's going on in Hong Kong, and that would cause social unrest, also like a lack of confidence among mainlanders. But later, the things unfold. It's impossible to hide it anymore. So, showing one side of the picture, they only show the violent and the very bad side of the picture, and ignoring the mass protest, which is very peaceful. Which was very peaceful and very organized. And they are only showing the very chaotic scenes to mainland peoples. They don't want the mainland people to see that kind of things, that they are losing control in Hong Kong. They don't want the mainland people to see that actually Beijing is losing control in Hong Kong and Hong Kong is turning chaotic. So they want to show that Hong Kong is still under their hand. And in Shenzhen side, there are a lot of military gathering in Hong Kong side, and the propaganda has been sending out message that the military can go over to Hong Kong anytime. Beijing is not only sending that kind of messages to Hong Kong society. In my point of view, I think they are rather sending the messages to mainland people. They are telling the mainland people that we got this under our control and we have all this. They want to assure mainlanders that we have this military and all these forces and these cards in our hand. So you don't need to worry that Beijing is still very strong. And still, a lot of mainlanders, they don't really know what's going on in Hong Kong because the lack of information and because all the free news and independent news are banned in mainland. So for example, my dad, he would ask me like, what's going on in Hong Kong exactly, because he know I travel to Hong Kong, and he would ask me, is it really true that there are foreign forces involved? And is it really true that there are people, protesters were paid by the Americans to go to the street? And they would question this. And also some people, they are really confused. I think mainlanders are really confused. They don't really know what's going on. And some of them, they also know that they cannot totally trust what the propaganda is telling them.
Hilaria, the authorities have seized on the presence of foreign flags, the inspiration of other movements around the world, and used that to further their argument that there are, I guess they call them, splittist tendencies in Hong Kong, that there are people who want to pull Hong Kong away from China. There are people who are accepting help and money and logistical aid from foreign actors on the ground. Is there anything to this? Should we put it to rest? Should we explore whether or not there are other places in the world that have an interest in keeping Hong Kong hot?
I would definitely put it to rest. It is true that there are some foreign flags that have been waved during the protests. Mostly it's been either American flags or British flags. I think we have to read this in two different ways. One is purely as provocation. The flags have shown to agitate the Beijing leadership so much that for especially quite young protesters, this is just too fun to not do. Waving this kind of flags is such a sure way to annoy those that they are angry at, that we should read them as a provocation. Then there has been one quite large, actually much larger than foreseen, protest that went all the way to the American Consul General, because a lot of people would like the United States to pass the Hong Kong Human Rights Bill, which is being discussed by Congress, and which would then impose a series of controls or make it harder for certain people that would be seen as having perpetrated human rights abuses in Hong Kong, make it harder for them to get a visa to go to the United States, or in some cases freeze assets, etc. So there is a portion of the population here in Hong Kong which supports this this bill, and so they waved the American flags when they marched to the American consulate. In Chinese propaganda, the whole 100 years of humiliation trope, what we have is a very heavy emphasis on the horrors of colonialism for a small group of pretty young people to wave the British flag is really the ultimate way of mocking this whole 100 years of humiliation trope. And by and large, if we look at the fact that at least on one occasion more than 2 million people took to the street, the number of foreign flags that we see remains really pretty small. That aside, Hong Kong is, by all definitions, the most cosmopolitan city in all of Asia. And while I think this whole talk of foreign interference, foreign forces, etc., is total nonsense, there is here partially a mixed population. Many Hong Kongers speak English. There are people from various other, let's say, heritage or descendant that do take part in the protests. And at the same time, the whole foreign interference has always been one of Beijing's favorite ways of saying that a problem is not really locally produced. And so we have seen, for example, photographs of journalists or bloggers being used by pro-Communist Party propaganda as proof that there were CIA operatives on the ground directing the protesters, when these people are people which are pretty well known to the foreign media corp here in Hong Kong as being, as I said, either journalists or bloggers. So this is just a very common propaganda tool of saying that whatever is happening is because of foreign interference.
But Ray, can I just say that I think we need to make clear that the propaganda story is bleaker than that, because it's absolutely true, as Anne and Ilaria have said, you know, very, very elegantly, that the propaganda machine in Beijing is doing what it does, which is tell half the story and focus on things that make the protesters look bad. But I fear, being based in Beijing myself, that when protesters are allowed to speak and are heard by mainlanders without that kind of filter, which sometimes happens because the mainland decides that what the protesters are saying will provoke mainland opinion, it goes down very badly. This is the problem. If mainlanders, if there was no censorship at all, and mainlanders could hear exactly what the protesters here in Hong Kong are saying, I believe that mainlanders would be very angry and would not support them. Because fundamentally, the demands of the Hong Kongers don't make sense to most mainlanders. Most mainlanders think of Hong Kongers as people who live in a richer, freer, cleaner city than any Chinese person does. They think they're spoiled brats. You hear that again and again in Chinese conversations on Chinese social media. They're spoiled brats who think that they are better than us, who sneer at us mainland tourists when we visit Hong Kong, who are rude, who are racist, who think that they are kind of honorary white people. They're kind of race traitors, is something you hear in China, that they think they're better than us. They're stuck up snobs, and it's time that we treated them very harshly. So you go on Chinese social media, and even allowing for the fact that other voices are going to be censored, so you only see those voices that the Chinese government allows, there are a large number of Chinese social media users quite sincerely of their own volition saying, send in the tanks, crush them, kill them, give them a lesson. The police should be more tough, more violent. Who do these people think they are? Because if you really boil down the argument from the Hong Kongers, it's that they don't want Hong Kong to become just another mainland city. Because if they were just another mainland city, they feel that they would live lives without real dignity and real autonomy. Well, the problem is that a lot of mainlanders, when they hear that, they're saying, do you say I've got no dignity? Are you saying I've got no autonomy? Because the people of Hong Kong are saying that they could not bear to live with the same social contract, that same grand bargain that mainlanders put up with. And that's really hard for mainlanders to hear and kind of offensive for them to hear. So you have to, I think, add that to the success of the kind of the sneakier propaganda. There's just a massive, massive perception gap between the 1.4 billion people on the mainland and the 8 million people here.
And does that mean the people of Hong Kong are really alone? If they are not supported in their aspirations by the people of the mainland, who, as David points out, can't even contextualize it, can't even understand it, and getting help from outside is risky, dangerous, even perceived as traitorous, are they really on their own, isolated?
There is a level of that. One of the things that you hear a lot on the streets is that what is happening in Hong Kong today could be happening tomorrow in Australia, in Canada, in the US, because Hong Kong is the front line. It's the first place where China meets a more cosmopolitan, a more international place. It's the place where China has made promises that it wanted to have registered at the United Nations and which it is not keeping. So when you look at what is happening here, you have to look at it in two different ways, I think. On one hand, there is this very strong identity issue, which is that Hong Kong people have never been ruled by communist China. They have never been shaped by the kind of propaganda and educational tools that communist China has used to shape its own population. So they have, they are a very free-thinking people. And they also care enormously about their own language, which is Cantonese and not Mandarin. And they see the desire for uniformity that is so widespread in the mainland as very undesirable and very worrying. And also they see themselves, as I was saying a second ago, just as the front line, the first place, the first international place in which China does not keep its promises in a very blatant way. And in this sense, yes, there is a feeling of being alone. It's quite interesting if you look at some of the strongest support that we have seen, again, manifesting itself mostly on social media, has come from exile groups of Tibetans and Uyghurs who feel that the kind of impatience that China has towards Hong Kongers saying we are different, we have a different identity, a different language, a different culture, is something that Tibetans and Uyghurs feel they have also experienced. And other than that, this is also one of the reasons why Hong Kongers have been, the protesters have been so so keen on having so much material translated into English, have so much of their own in debate or their own posters and slogans printed on international newspapers. There have been at least three rounds of crowd-sourced, crowd-funded mass publications of explanations into a number of international languages of what the protests are about, which have been published in newspapers around the world. And the desire also that you can see when we see people like the singer Dennis Ho or Joshua Wong, who is an activist from the party Demo Sister, one of the protagonists of the Umbrella Movement in 2014, or other people who go to the United States, is precisely to drive home this point that what Hong Kong is experiencing today might be what other countries around the world may be experiencing in the future. And they are asking for the whole world's attention precisely not to feel this sense of loneliness that you were talking about.
As a mainlander, I think a major point that is missing sometimes in the Western reporting is what mainland people really think about Hong Kong protesters. As we all know, it's very difficult to know the public opinion in China. So it's very difficult to understand what Chinese people truly think about us. So often what we can see on social media is that kind of very hawkish and very nationalistic voices and And of course, we know that kind of voice is always very loud and always louder than those more reasonable and more rational voices. So I think there are a lot of, in the reporting, a lot of time, mainlanders are being portrayed as a very nationalistic and patriotic people who are very anti-Hong Kong and disagree with Hong Kong people's demands and their movement, often making references to those very hawkish sounds on the social media. But actually, views are diverse and complex in mainland. Mainland people also have very mixed and complex feelings about what's going on in Hong Kong. There are different levels of thinking because the population is so huge. And for example, like I would often get questioned, people would really think about, and people would question, what is really going on in Hong Kong? And what we hear from the propaganda, is it really true? And they really want to know what's going on. And it's all because lack of information. And people, there are people who do not believe in propaganda wholeheartedly. We should be careful that to not to paint all the mainlanders has same view towards Hong Kong. They are diverse and different kind of thinking.
We've been hearing from David Rennie and Ilaria Maria Sala on the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. We've also been hearing from an anonymous contributor who's asked that her name not be used. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from David Rennie, who's a columnist for The Economist, from Ilaria Maria Sala, a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong, and a Chinese reporter who, for security reasons, prefers to remain anonymous. For the purpose of this interview, we're calling her Anne. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word, and now back to our program.
As social media becomes more advanced and more capable of getting messages of all kinds around the world instantly, is it also more capable of manipulating public opinion and the content being manipulated itself? When mainlanders see things that purport to be from Hong Kong, when Hong Kongers see things on social media that are said to be involved with their struggle, can everybody be sure that they're not being played, that these images, messages, opinions are not being created by actors who want to influence the struggle one way or the other, but aren't necessarily working in their best interest? And if you are one of the young people on the streets of Hong Kong, is there a risk in going on social media, saying who you are, using your own face, using your own name? Don't you have to be careful about your own future, Anne?
Yes, I think among the protesters, there are a lot of fear now revealing their identity or to be found out who they really are. So they there could be some danger happen to them and even their family. I think they are indeed very worried about that. So nowadays, I feel it's getting increasingly difficult to get people to talk to you and to give their real identity to you. They are more unwilling to do that. But still, I think even for myself, I think people nowadays, because they call it white terror, because of this terror, people are scared to voice out. And it is suffocating sometimes that you feel that you want to tell the world and tell the people who are not here what's happening. But in the meantime, you think because of your own safety, you shouldn't do that. But still, I think someone needs to tell what's going on and to get their voice heard.
Ilaria, you wanted to say?
I wanted to say that at the moment, Hong Kong is absolutely awash in fake news. You have the Chinese propaganda system, of course, which is producing a vast quantity of photographs and declarations and all sorts of manipulated information. But then also from Hong Kong, we have a similar thing with this very persistent rumor that someone was killed in the subway system a few weeks ago, which has generated a whole lot of false information circulating around. So the fact that there is so much and false information circulating, we also have a lot that is against the protesters, but is also produced in Hong Kong itself, not just in the mainland. And what we see is that while it's pretty clear what Beijing is trying to do by producing this fake information and muddying the waters and just giving a counter-narrative to everything that is happening, on a local level, what we see in Hong Kong, where there is this flood of fake news coming out basically every day, is that we have an extremely polarized society. Hong Kong has never been this polarized. And through this false information that is circulating, what we see is two very contrasting narratives. We also have the huge problem of the daily 4 p.m. Press conference from the police force, which is also producing quite a lot of fake news every day, since even when they are faced with pretty clear evidence, photographic evidence, videos or medical records of people who have been beaten up by the police, they simply deny all evidence. And the anger that this produces is such that then from the protester side, you will see inflated claims to try and bring home a reality that they feel is being suffocated by the authorities and Beijing propaganda and the smaller but still significant part of the Hong Kong population that is not supporting the protesters. So in this environment, which is getting really quite toxic, it's very important to consume the news in a very alert manner, knowing exactly what you're looking at and trying to have as many sources confirming what you're looking at as possible, because the environment has been getting extremely toxic. And as Anne was saying, of course, now the dangers are such that most protesters will be covering their face when they are protesting. They will be trying to hide their identity. But we see also the authority, the police force coming into the streets without their ID numbers displayed, covering their faces, sometimes doing covert operations by dressing up as protesters. So it is a very volatile situation. It's a moment in which knowing whom you're talking to is pretty hard. And people are trying to counter these dangers by using smaller and smaller groups on Telegram especially, and some other channels on social media, in order to try and move only among those they do trust. So while this may protect some people, it produces yet more fractures and fragmentations in society.
Making it even more complex is the fact that this is, in turns, quite proudly, a leaderless movement, or a movement with distributed influence and distributed powerful individuals. David Rennie, does that make it also harder to stay on task, make clear your political aims, keep a coherent narrative about what it is you're doing as you disrupt the operation of this crowded, complicated city week after week?
Well, of course, and I think Beijing bears a large part of the blame, because this is really, you know, the third or fourth generation of opposition kind of activism we've seen since, you know, Britain gave up Hong Kong in 1997. You know, and the very first generation was basically a bunch of British-trained barristers and lawyers who were extremely moderate, willing to work with the Chinese authorities to try and use one country, two systems, to try and expand Hong Kong's freedoms as far as they could. But they had no dreams of becoming an independent country or really challenging Beijing's right to reclaim sovereignty, because Hong Kong is, we should be very clear, for all that protesters may sometimes say that, you know, this could be happening in Australia or America next, Hong Kong isn't a foreign country. Hong Kong is absolutely 100% a part of China. And so everything that happens here is ultimately in China's gift. They are in charge of this place since 1997. So the Beijing authorities, they got rid and marginalized that first generation of very moderate lawyers and basically made sure that they really didn't have much political power and used their money and influence to try and marginalize them within Hong Kong politics. You then saw that movement. Remember Joshua Wong, who was in Washington recently, the very young protester who came to prominence in 2014 with the Umbrella Movement. That was, if you like, the second generation of kind of post-handover, real kind of visible activism. A lot of them were Christians. They were preaching civil disobedience in a kind of Gandhian style. They occupied the center of Hong Kong for a while. Some of them were stuck in jail for organizing those protests. So Beijing thought they'd been clever once again because they had stuck those people in jail. Well, now you're right, Ray. We have a leaderless movement. Well, guess what? If you marginalize the most moderate and then you jail the next most moderate, then what you're left with is people who are very hard to deal with. And I think the other tragedy is we don't really know what the political sort of outcome, what a good political outcome of these protests could be. So it's possible to feel tremendous personal human sympathy for the bravery of these protesters and the peaceful ones, certainly. And it's possible to absolutely sympathize with their desire to stop one country, two systems being eroded and chipped away. That is an absolutely clearly kind of noble cause. But then you have to ask, what's next? How is this going to get better? Is China ever likely under this Chinese government to give Hong Kong more freedom? And I'm afraid my bleak answer is no, it's not. That is not going to happen anytime soon. And so then you find yourself thinking, well, then what happens to this energy on the streets? Where does this go if there really is not a constructive political outlet? And that makes me very, very kind of bleak about what is going to happen here in the kind of short and medium term.
And in Ilaria, David paints a distressing scenario, I guess, for people who nurture ideas of a future freer China. But if you play this game out more weekends, more months down the road, it's hard to see this succeeding, even with the strategic brilliance of the protesters, even with the deep sympathy among the common people of Hong Kong for this movement. A lot of people have stuck their neck out, taken risks to aid and support the protesters and their movement. It's hard to see how this has a happy ending, isn't it?
Frankly, yes, but it's also hard to see how it's going to end. We may now be having the false impression that the protests are getting more violent but smaller. And I call it false because what has been happening is that while people still support it, they are not going to come out if a protest has not been authorized. Especially Hong Kong has quite a tradition of having people come out with their children, with their families, and joining demonstrations with their families. And right now, since the police has been blocking demonstrations, and using so much crowd control weapons like tear gas especially, but also pepper spray, beanbag bullets, and sponge bullets, fewer people are coming out because they feel this, it's more dangerous. What we can see looking ahead is that this may continue for quite a while, and Beijing has also been putting into place a new tactic to try and quell the protests, or at least quell the support for them, which has been to go after the companies that have had very vocal members of especially their unions joining the protests. We have seen this quite dramatically with Cathay Pacific. We have seen it in a different way with the Underground Corporation, the MTR, the Mass Transport Railway, where Beijing now controls the, let's say, the in various ways, through checking the social media, asking the persons directly, asking to see the phones. They check what the political sympathies of the cabin crew of Cathay Pacific flights are, especially if they are flying either directly to China or crossing the air above China. And for what we know, there have been about 300 people who have lost their job at Cathay Pacific because either on their phones or on their social media, the authorities, Chinese authorities or the company authorities, have found support for the demonstrations. The MTR at the beginning of the protest was dispatching special trains to allow protesters to go home if there was a major influx of participants. Now they are routinely closing down the stations where protests are occurring, which is one of the reasons why fewer people are participating, because just on protest days, transport has been getting much harder. And there are more companies which have been firing people who have been openly siding with the protests and taking part. So what people are now facing is that whatever is happening in terms of the demonstrations themselves, they may be a long drawn out period of retaliation against those who took part and supported. We saw already this once in the last 5 years, where throughout these 5 years we have had trials and prison sentences for those who had taken part in the Umbrella Movement in 2014. And now the stakes are even higher. People are losing their job. People are being asked to show the content of their phone and the content of their social media. So what people are fearing right now is that if this stops now, all that is achieved is even more controls. If this doesn't stop, however, there is no clear path ahead. Nobody seems to be having a real roadmap of what they hope to achieve by continuing the protests. So we are definitely in a very delicate time.
Anne?
I guess the problem here is, in the long run, we don't see how to solve in fundamentally something that we don't see where the way out is how to win the heart of Hong Kong young people. And since this movement already reinforced the identity of their Hong Konger identity, and it's this young generation is further and further away from the mainland, from Beijing. And that's something more subtle. And also in the long run, how can Beijing win these young people over? How can Beijing to create this identity that Hong Kong people feel comfortable with? If that's not possible, and if the Hong Kong young people just think they are totally different from the mainlanders. And then this young generation and these young people will always be a problem to Beijing. And I don't see a solution to that. And definitely Beijing has did such a terrible job in making these young people to feel that they belong to China or feel they belong to this bigger country. And instead, the young people now, their sentiments are more anti-Beijing and anti-Communist Party. And yeah, so in that sense, Beijing did a really, really bad job. And I don't know how Beijing can solve this and can rebuild this trust again in the future. And if that problem doesn't be solved, then when these young people grow up, Hong Kong will be in their hand, and they will still think the unrest still exists, and this kind of situation might happen again. So that's the dilemma there that I see, which could cause really big problem in the long run, and which make one country two system very difficult.
Back when Hong Kong rejoined China, it was widely discussed that China wouldn't go out of its way to interfere with the operation of Hong Kong, which was a wealthy, thriving place, which represented a large share of the overall Chinese economy. Now, more than 20 years later, the percentage of the Chinese economy represented by Hong Kong's economic activity is significantly smaller, because mainland China's economy has grown so rapidly and become so powerful, so huge. Is the downside risk for China overreacting? Is the downside risk for China finally just tiring of all this and taking a really strong stand against Hong Kong lower now that Hong Kong is not as important as a shop window to the world as it was in 1997, David?
So it's really interesting if you look back at what people were writing in 1997 when Britain gave back Hong Kong to China. A lot of those predictions really now look completely wrong. Remember that the Chinese economy was far, far smaller. And as you say, back in 97, Hong Kong represented about 18% of Chinese GDP. It's now below 3% of Chinese GDP, not because Hong Kong's much poorer, but because China's just gigantically richer and larger. Back in 97, you will read, you know, big editorials in big Western newspapers confidently saying that Hong Kong was going to be this Trojan horse for democracy that was going to infect the larger body of China with democracy, and that China's sort of democratic dissident movement was going to get a tremendous kind of boost from having Hong Kong in their midst. In fact, it's a tragedy for people who want to see kind of more freedom and democracy in China. In fact, the systems of control and propaganda are so strong that, in fact, now in 2019, the one thing that the Chinese communist leadership in Beijing doesn't really have to worry about is contagion. I mean, there is not tremendous bubbling support for Hong Kong on the mainland side of the border. So that prediction has not come true. But your question is the right one, which is essentially, if the outside world does not want to see the tanks rolling through the streets of Hong Kong and, you know, spilling appalling amounts of blood, what appeal can be made to the Chinese government's self-interest? What is the argument that the West can make to China to say something about Hong Kong is so precious that you shouldn't break it by sending in the troops and ending one country, two systems? And as you said in your question, the economics now looks a little less powerful now that China itself is so wealthy. And that contagion prediction that we heard in 1997 actually no longer looks as relevant, because the Chinese mainland has done such a fantastic job of inculcating kind of propaganda and nationalist education, even though, as Anne absolutely correctly says, China is a big and diverse place, and you know, we shouldn't just tar everyone with the same brush and say they're all kind of as rabidly nationalistic as the loudest voices. So then what are we left with? What is the argument for Beijing not to just crush Hong Kong and tear up one country, two systems and say it's now one country, one system. Well, there's a couple of economic arguments which are actually quite important still. You know, this is a place with its own hard currency. The Hong Kong dollar is convertible. It's pegged to the US dollar. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange is the world's second largest stock exchange. It's an incredibly important place for big Chinese companies to raise foreign capital when they want to go to the market. So for very big Chinese companies, if they want to take that first step into international markets and borrow in international currency, they go to Hong Kong first, and that's still an incredibly important shop window. But I think the really scary scenario that doesn't involve tanks on the streets that you do hear people talk about is stagnation, that if they decide, as Ilaria and Anne have been saying, that there isn't really a political path forward that's going to please all sides, that maybe for Beijing, they just let this place kind of wither. It becomes just a stock exchange. It becomes just a place where lawyers sign contracts. But that kind of that hope that the Beijing side had that China would become the kind of the dominant identity for Hong Kongers doesn't happen. As Anne says absolutely correctly, you know, they look like they're losing the hearts and minds of lots of members of the younger generation. Maybe the communist leaders in Beijing just think, you know what? Let them stew. We'll make it a stock exchange and a place where people do some legal contract business. But as for the rest of it, let them stew and we'll just concentrate on getting the rest of China rich.
Is there some risk for Chinese citizens elsewhere in the world to be seen supporting this movement when they go home? Will it be known that they supported the movement? Ilaria, are there people watching? People watching your social media account, people watching your communications with family and friends in other parts of China?
Yes, there are definitely. People have said many times that if they support something that is not what Beijing wants them to support, even if they are abroad in the US, in Australia or elsewhere, they can get a call from their own family who tells them that the families have received complaints from Chinese police, the families who are still in China, I mean. So definitely there are risks involved. As far as those who do not have Chinese nationality, however, I think that there are many ways to support not only democracy in Hong Kong, but more generally, greater respect for human rights in China by making sure that as electors, we ask our representatives to make clear that these concerns are important to us and to convey this message to Beijing. I think Beijing remains quite keen on having a good reputation abroad. And in spite of the fact that this may be diminishing currently or because of the greater economic power that China enjoys now, it's still sensitive to international public opinion and pressure. But as David was saying before, countries are pretty shy, they're pretty cowardish when it comes to actually putting pressure or even saying that these are topics that we care about. So I think as electors, this is one thing we can definitely do, make sure that our representative know that we believe human rights are important.
The months to come will tell us what direction these trends are heading in and whether there's a distressing or heroic outcome at the end of all this. But your insights have been very interesting. Thanks for taking the time. David Rennie of The Economist, good to talk to you as always.
Thank you.
Journalist Ilaria Sala, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
And Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured David Rennie. He's a columnist for The Economist. He was joined by Ilaria Maria Sala, a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong, and our anonymous source from Hong Kong, a Chinese journalist. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.